Hello, this is Françoise Mathieu, and this is webinar 9, and the topic is working with colleagues. I bring you back to the balance map that I had been discussing in the past webinars. I invite you to look at the component that you see in the bottom here called managing occupational stress and resentment. Now, obviously, this is a very big topic, and the reality is I've had the privilege of meeting, oh my gosh, probably over 100,000 different professionals who work in education and healthcare and law enforcement and child welfare. I mean, that's what I do. I spend my weeks talking to folks who work in these challenging work environments. And over the years, I have definitely had a chance to talk to some folks who were feeling, you know, really stressed and overwhelmed and angry sometimes about their working conditions, certain aspects of their work. And I wanted to start kind of thinking about how do we navigate that when we don't necessarily have control over many aspects. You can imagine that working in the prison system, and maybe you know some folks who do, being a correctional officer, you can't change the entire correctional system. I mean, unless you're some incredibly influential person. So you need to make some choices about what you can change, what you can't, and some daily decisions about how does managing the things you're frustrated about your workplace, how does that affect you, your loved ones, your friendships, your health, the quality of work you do with the kids? Those are all elements that we have these regular conversations with staff about. So the first thing I want to invite you to think about is whether you've ever experienced what I call the must be nice phenomena. The must be nice phenomena happens at work and at home. When, let's take a home example, have you ever had a situation where a friend of yours started taking, you know, really good care of themselves? And maybe they joined a gym, or they started power walking, or, you know, they started doing something really good. And although you were happy for them, you also kind of had that little feeling of, must be nice to have time for that. You know, I certainly have had it in the past. And I actually started realizing that it was very good information about where I was at and what I was feeling. So I'll give you an example, but of course they're very individual, so yours might be different. As I mentioned in a past webinar, I used to be a long distance runner, and it was a great stress relief for me. I used to go for a run, and it's like everything that I had been worried about would not only fall off, but I would also get new insights and ideas about things. It was really good for me. And then I got injured and I wasn't able to run anymore. And I had to have surgery, and, you know, that part of my life is over. And I had a really hard time with that. And for a couple of 2-3 years after not being able to run anymore, I had like evil thoughts about runners. You know, I'd see someone running and I'd think to myself, oh, who runs at this time of the day? You know, who runs with that outfit on? Or who, you know, I started having these not very generous thoughts until I finally realized that the truth is that I missed running terribly, and somehow their activities were kind of pushing my own feelings of longing or missing something. And I saw the same thing sometimes with friends of mine who might, you know, be better parents than me. I mean, I'm a pretty good parent, but there's certain things that I never enjoyed doing. And, you know, that might be very individual. So I didn't like crafts. I didn't love all the glitter and the paint and, you know, and I remember having a friend who'd say to me, oh, we did a craft weekend. And instead of just thinking, good for you, that's awesome, I remember at some point having kind of this weird little feeling of, must be nice, you know. And I started realizing that that emotion is actually a sign of longing or guilt or envy, if you will. So I started noticing that in the workplace as well, because as I've mentioned, I work with nurses a lot. And I've checked this out with nurses, and they're not offended by this, but nurses can be mean to each other. You know, we can be hard on the new rookies coming in. And sometimes, you know, nurses would say to me, they would have a brand new nurse come in, and maybe she would take an extra few minutes off her break, and they'd be the same. They'd be like, must be nice to take an extra long break. Must be nice to call in sick. So I want to invite you to think about that. Have you had this must be nice reaction in your personal and professional life? What is the underlying emotion? Like, what is this really about? And what is the impact that it has on our social relationships at work? What we found, and there's a term that's been used that's called horizontal violence or lateral violence. And we're not talking about physical violence here. We're talking about bullying, cliques, isolating other people, you know, in the workplace. And what we have found is that lateral violence or workplace toxicity is directly correlated to the level of stress and the lack of resources and control we have in the workplace. So again, you know, hospital emergency wards, prisons, child welfare, busy schools. We found that there are some higher rates of workplace conflict when there's compassion fatigue and overload. So it's just an important thing to kind of keep in mind and to notice. And I think we can all agree that some of our colleagues, or maybe yourself, depends who's listening to this, some of us are really burnt out. I like to call them the Eeyores of the workplace, you know, from Winnie the Pooh, where, you know, there's a new policy that comes in and their immediate reaction is negative. You know, that's never going to work. We tried that 25 years ago. And what we started realizing is that not only are those folks obviously having potentially a negative impact on the workplace, but they're also really struggling. And so I tried to have a compassionate shift and think about, I remember working somewhere where there was definitely the Eeyore in the workplace. I mean, literally every time there was a new policy or rule, regulation or announcement, could even be positive, she always had something negative to say. And at first, I'll be honest with you, it really got on my nerves. And after a while, I started thinking, you know what? She's in the red zone. She's really struggling with this. Excuse me. And it kind of helped me think about how much power was I going to give her? So was I going to let her be the person who's going to influence, you know, the entire workplace climate? And secondly, how could I best support her without letting her have control over everything that was going on around us? And so I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. So I think we can acknowledge that there are certain elements of workplace toxicity, and some schools are better than others. And I'm sure if you've worked in a variety of places, you will probably find that some schools were much kind of more enjoyable to work in than others, right? And what we found is that that has a lot to do with the who is working there, obviously, who is in charge. So who is the principal, who is the person in charge of, depending where, what kind of work you do, you know, who's the person in charge of special ed, who's the person in charge of what have you. So that made a big difference with leadership. And it also had to do with a couple of key individuals who were either the positive elders or the negative elders. And I think that we can agree that every workplace has a group of people who've been around there for a long time, and some of them are amazing. And I hope you've had the opportunity to work with some amazing elders, such as, you know, people who've been there for a long time, and they really are mentors and they're leaders. And we just recently had the person who was in the head of guidance who retired from my daughter's school, and everyone was like, don't go. Like, she just had this incredible outlook. And I think she even worked longer than she should have. She, in a sense, like she could have retired, but she was just this incredible person. And I'm really interested in that. And I'm really interested in having conversations with really resilient practitioners. They've been there for years. And yes, they've dealt with some difficult things and challenges and new policies and, you know, a whole bunch of stuff they might not agree with. And yet they seem to have a way to be supportive and good mentors for the younger generation. So hopefully you've had some of those. But can we also agree respectfully that sometimes our folks who've been around for a long time, and it might be you who's listening to this call, you know who you are, we're kind of crispy fried and we don't have that positive outlook on life and we don't feel excited about the incoming new hires. And so it's kind of an invitation to think about you individually, who are you spending your time with and how much are you allowing that toxicity to have an impact on your relationships with others in the workplace and with the students as well. So as I mentioned briefly in another call, I at some point had to make some decisions about my work environment, and I was turning into somebody I didn't really like. I was turning into someone who was having the post-meeting bitch fest after every single meeting. And, you know, I did that for a while. And I mean, it was legitimate in the sense that there were legitimate complaints for me to have. There were some things I was very frustrated about. But I realized at some point that if I was going to do that every single day and, you know, meet with my bestie in the broom closet and have a bitch fest about what just happened in the meeting, well, nothing else was going to change. It was just going to be like that forever. And so at that moment, she and I decided that we either needed to leave, like go somewhere else, or we needed to change it up. And we decided to change it up and change the way that we talked about work and also pick our battles. And it didn't mean that we were always happy about the workplace. There were times where we were not, but we also just decided to be constructive. And I'll be honest with you, it made a huge positive impact on actually our own workplace satisfaction. And that was a really interesting kind of byproduct. So I want to invite you to think about, how is stress affecting you and your team? How are you as individuals affected? How is your workplace affected? And how are you seeing this stress affecting organizations as a whole and society? I think we can all agree, based on the last couple of conversations we've had about the adverse childhood experiences and the window of tolerance, that I think you'd probably agree that your most challenging students and families are also involved often in other parts of the system. They may be involved in some complex healthcare situations. Some of them might be involved in child welfare situations. They basically are the same families, if that makes sense. And as we are all trying to support families who often have had really complicated lives in the first place, what is the impact on our whole organization and society when we often don't have all or enough resources to best support them, and also don't have enough resources to support our teams, who are you guys, who are the most important elements of this workplace? So those are some of the questions kind of want to invite you to think about, and also to think about, what are you seeing concretely? So many of you who replied to the survey gave us some really concrete examples of stress effects that you're seeing, you know, for yourself and for your team and for your school. What are you watching? What are you witnessing? Excuse me. And I invite you to think about, you know, next days and weeks, go out there and check it out. Be an observer for a second. Are you noticing all the different elements that we've discussed in these webinars? We know that when there's a lot of stress and not enough resources, we know that we individually have increased risk for emotional numbing, right? Checking out. Remember hypoarousal. From withdrawing. Remember I mentioned that I certainly find that when I'm in the overload zone, I withdraw from my colleagues or from my family. Maybe we've also seen communication breakdown. I don't know if you've seen this where if we're really stressed out and overwhelmed, we tend to misread what certain things, you know, certain comments, or we'll kind of misunderstand each other. And that can lead to, of course, increase in conflict as well. There might be more anger and aggression. People might be more defensive, negative attitude, and more conflict and breakdown. This cartoon says management are fighting over the best way to resolve conflict in the workplace, which I thought was kind of funny. What is the impact on the environment and morale? So we know that we are less productive when we're stressed. It's also, by the way, very interesting, because if you look at a completely different field, Google, for example, and all those fancy, you know, tech companies that invent all sorts of cool stuff, the Google office, my brother actually was just talking about this the other day, because he's really interested in creativity in the workplace. The Google office is not structured in the same way as our workplaces. Some of you maybe have seen the movie The Internship, which is kind of a joke about the Google office. But apparently some of it is absolutely true, where, you know, they have a lot of unstructured time, they have beautiful work environments, they have swings, they have slides, they have ping pong tables. And it turns out, of course, I don't think that Google, the big boss of Google, necessarily cares about his staff emotionally or personally. Maybe he does. But what they've realized is that having creative staff. In order to have creative staff, you have to have an environment that is conducive to that. And what we know is in our environments, we're not going to be very creative when we're in hyperarousal and we're responding to crises all the time. So productivity goes down, of course, because there's just too much to do and not enough time. And then, of course, as a result, we'll see all the consequences like increase in sick leave and workplace conflict and all that kind of stuff. And those are some of the conversations we have with senior leadership when we're trying to do what we call making the business case for organizational health, is we will actually have conversations with leaders about why does investing in your team make such a difference? And that's a whole conversation we have with them. So basically, what is organizational health and why does it matter? And Dr. Fisher has spent years talking about this, and she gives a really great analogy where she'll say, listen, your organization, your school board, that's the, organizational structure of who does what and who's in charge and all that. That is called the skeleton or the architecture of the organization, right? That's the framework. But the fact is that we're all humans. And organizational health is basically the human element, is basically the muscles and tendons and, blood vessels and skin. Like, that's what animates the skeleton of the horse, if you will. What runs the machine is not the structure, it's the human element. And that's really complex because, as I've established, we are all complex folks. We have all sorts of issues of our own. We have strengths, we have weaknesses, we have personalities, and also then the impact of stress has an impact on that. And the more we understand that, the more we can see how common some of the challenges that you're experiencing, we have seen them in so many high-stress, trauma-exposed organizations. And it's fascinating to me how I could be in Oregon talking to a school board there, and I was actually working with some of the EAs there, and they were describing almost identical challenges to what I've seen in Ontario. So that really fascinates me. So to go back to the model that we talked about a long time ago, a few webinars ago, one of the things I invite you to think about is what is within your control and what isn't. So you may or may not have any control or influence over the organizational system, but you may have some amount of control over what you do as a professional. So whether you choose to take some extra training, even though sometimes it's just more demand on your time, and I completely understand that. You may choose to have strategic alliances, so who you're going to spend time with in terms of your colleagues. Individually, hopefully you have some amount of control over what you do and how you take care of yourself. And then we kind of overlap that with Pat's model, which it's going to look a little complicated, but it's actually really simple once you look at it. So what we've developed over time, or rather I should say what Dr. Pat Fisher has developed over time, is called the 12-factor organizational health model. And what she's demonstrated in her work is that we have three foundation elements down here. Wow, my drawing skills leave a little bit to desire. Here we go. So these are the three foundational elements. And until you have reasonably healthy leadership, succession planning, I'm going to explain what that is in a minute, and employee health and wellness, you cannot expect to have good communication, trust and respect. Wow, I'm not very skilled at this. You cannot expect to have trust and respect and good communication and a really productive team unless the foundation elements have been looked at. You can't expect to have good commitment unless the foundation elements have been addressed. So the way we think about the foundation elements are the following. Leadership, what does that mean? Well, it won't come as a surprise to any of you that leaders are people too, and that not only are leaders people too, but they're also dealing with their complex stress effects themselves. It turns out, and I know because I'm a therapist and I've spent years listening to people's challenging, situations, that it doesn't really matter whether you're a superintendent or a school principal or a teacher or a CYW or a TA or an EA, everyone's got stuff. And it also doesn't really matter, interestingly, I think sometimes we think that obviously making a higher income is better because life is less stressful. That makes sense. But what we found out really quickly is that at some point there's a limit that your level of income it's been assessed that once you make a certain amount of money, people who make more money than that are no happier than people who make a certain amount of money. So once your basic needs have been met, it turns out that you could be a general in the military and have identical stresses and challenges as the corporals. And so it turns out, of course, that leaders are not only dealing with managing the complexities of the schools and the boards and everything else, they're also dealing with their own, sometimes, lack of training. It turns out that a lot of leaders are promoted. I don't know how it works in your schools, but often you don't go to, you know, some specific training to learn to manage a school or to manage a school board. You are just promoted. And so what we found is on average, it takes a minimum of 2 years for someone to become reasonably competent in their new job. So that could actually be a new hire at your maybe one of your EA, new hire at a college or whatever, or it could also be a new principal. And it turns out that you need to give a minimum of 2 years for that new principal to develop fairly competently in their job. And before that, it turns out that they have a massive learning curve. And it also turns out that just because you're a good teacher doesn't mean you're a good manager. And that's a fact. And so those are all really interesting components to kind of, you know, factor in. The second piece is succession planning. And what succession planning refers to is three things. Dealing with retirements. So as the baby boomer generation retires, what do we do with that? Losing all of that knowledge. Maybe sometimes it's a relief that some people go, and other times it's a loss, as I mentioned before. So how do we deal with people who leave through retirement? How do we deal with the losses of our workplace through illness or stress leave? How do we deal with attracting new people? And how do we deal with keeping them? So in child welfare, it's a very interesting statistic that child welfare workers are staying in child protection on average for only 2 years before they quit because the work is just grueling. And so in the United States, on average, teachers, and as you know, the education system in the States is really incredibly challenging, teachers are staying on average 3 years before they quit teaching. So succession planning is how are you replacing your strong talent, how are you keeping your talent, and how are you keeping everybody, you know, relatively happy. And then the last element is employee health, which is what the focus of all of these webinars is kind of focusing on that piece. And I hope you understand by now, if you've stuck with me for all these 9 webinars, that these are all interconnected. And that's why focusing on this pillar makes sense, even though it may feel like it's not addressing the larger issues at hand about resources and everything else. So strategies I want to recommend to you. Kyle Killian, who wrote a paper on this a couple of years ago, said that social support is the most significant factor associated with satisfaction. Compassion satisfaction refers to feeling really good about the challenging job that we do. So positive alliances have been associated with the most significant factor. So social support in the workplace is crucial. And so I'm going to invite you to go through a couple of quick reflection activities. So think about where you work. Are there ways in which your colleagues have provided support to you? Think about ways in which that's happened. What do you most appreciate about your colleagues? What do you find supportive and helpful? And you can pause this and have a think about that. The next activity is, I'm going to put this sheet on the handouts on the website. How and when do you and your team spend time with each other? And I invite you to think about formal occasions versus informal. How often do you meet? How long for? How inclusive are those events? And how helpful are you finding these events in terms of enhancing your sense of social support? And again, this is very individual. Some of us don't enjoy those occasions, and that's fine. So this is the most important chart here, and I'll invite you to do that when this is done as well. So finally, can you think of one positive workplace alliance that you could make? And if you are working in an environment where you really can't identify folks that, you know, you connect or feel comfortable with, could you go outside of your school to make a positive alliance with somebody else. So can we agree that now with social media and smartphones and texting and all that, there's so many ways to connect with other people. For the longest time, my office, so we finally got an office, like a formal, you know, brick and mortar office for Tend about almost a year ago. But for the first 15 years, I worked out of my, basically my home office. And I didn't feel isolated because I'm kind of an introvert and I'm happy to be by myself. But if I needed to connect, I could easily connect with my friends or my colleagues by texting, phoning, Skyping, and so on. So can you identify somebody that you could connect to who is outside of your school who could become a really good source of support for you? So those are the three activities that I recommend. So going back, so think three ways your colleagues have provided support to you. What do you most appreciate about them? What is helpful and supportive? And I think that's very individual. How and when do you and your team spend time with each other? Do you have a lot of formal occasions? I know that in the school, sometimes they're very few and far between. So it might be better to focus on the informal ways in which we can connect with each other. And as I mentioned before, in their debriefing webinar, they don't need to be long events, but I think that social connection makes a huge difference. So are there ways for you to do that? And finally, is there a positive workplace alliance you could make? So this is not a giving, you know, you can be loving and understanding of the burnt out person, but they don't need to necessarily take all the oxygen and the air in the room. So are there certain people you could make an agreement with that you're, you know, some days you're not going to feel like this is the best job ever and you're not going to be positive? We can be neutral in those days. We don't have to be negative all the time. We can make decisions about that for ourselves. All right, that's webinar 9. I hope you found it helpful. Questions, don't hesitate to get in touch. Thanks. I'll see you next time.